Berlin Security Beat is an original podcast produced by the Center for National Security at the Hertie School in Berlin. Welcome to episode 7 of our third season, where we delve into the world of cybersecurity. In this episode, we tackle a pressing yet often overlooked issue, unlawful digital surveillance and spyware. Joining us today are two experts from Amnesty International's Tech Security Lab, Rebecca White and Alina Castillo-Jimenez. As researchers and advisors for Amnesty, they will bring invaluable insights into how spyware operates, the surveillance industry, and the direct impact of these technologies on individuals. So, let's get right to it. Rebecca, Alina, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for having us.
In this episode, we're looking in depth into unlawful digital surveillance. This is a core part of state repression, something we've previously covered on this podcast with Professor Anita Godes. Alina, could you begin by giving us a brief introduction into what unlawful digital surveillance is and who are its primary targets?
Yeah, so in plain language, unlawful digital surveillance is the use of technology to spy on people. Our team, which is the Security Lab at Amnesty International, specifically focuses on targeted surveillance, which implies a concrete target. And because of that, it is sort of like the differentiator with the mass surveillance, which people typically relate to facial recognition technology, for example. So in the case of unlawful targeted digital surveillance, we're talking about a user making use of technology, resources, tools, software, hardware that facilitate spying on a specific individual or a specific group of individuals for a purpose, right? So I think that from that lens, it also allows us as Amnesty International to also understand unlawful targeted surveillance as an act that can cause human rights violations. And in particular, we talk often about violations of the right to privacy, the right to freedom of expression, and even freedom of peaceful assembly. And it's a practice that tends to be one of the many tools in the toolkit for state repression. I mean, I always say that it doesn't happen in a vacuum. Unlawful targeted surveillance, whenever we have documented it, oftentimes is related, or it is rather an indicator of crackdowns on freedom of expression and freedom of peaceful assembly, just to mention two. And through our work, we have seen that targets of this phenomenon tend to be journalists and human rights defenders and other members of civil society. Through our research, we've even documented instances of government officials and UN officials being targeted. And in the past, even our own staff has been targeted through unlawful digital surveillance.
Thank you for that. Rebecca, you guys work at the Amnesty International Security Lab. Could you tell us a little bit about how your team works and how you approach uncovering and researching unlawful digital surveillance?
Yeah, so at Amnesty Security Lab, we are a multidisciplinary team. We're made up of technologists, of course, but also researchers, campaigners, advocates, and colleagues as well, working on the operational side of things, and also training and community engagement. So we're pretty diverse in terms of roles and also in terms of where we're based. Alina is joining us from the US. We have colleagues in Argentina, Tunisia, all over Europe, and I'm speaking to you from London in the UK. In terms of how we go about our work, our technologists use their expertise to carry out forensic investigations into cyber attacks, obviously, against civil society, and also research into the industry itself. So, you know, corporate structures, other open source materials. But as a whole in the team, we use a combination of more traditional human rights methods alongside that. So that's, you know, obvious methods like desk research, interviews, focus group discussions, quantitative research methods. And all our research, as Alina's touched on, is conducted on the basis of international human rights law. So that means that everything that we publish, all of our calls, our recommendations, criticisms or claims, they're all based on the same international human rights law principles, and they all address like a specific human rights situation. And so our ultimate goal isn't just to document and call out these abuses that are happening and that are being enabled by technology is to stop them happening, right? So to prevent them and end them. And at Amnesty International, this is part of a wider strategy that all of us employ to affect change. You know, that's what we aim for. And it's important to show these appalling things are happening, but we also need to show it doesn't have to be that way and how and why it doesn't have to be that way. So part of that change, importantly, involves securing justice for people, in this case, the many people that have been harmed by unlawful targeted surveillance. So not just preventing stuff from happening in the future, but looking at remedy and accountability for the stuff that's already happened. And alongside our research, we use campaigning and advocacy to disrupt the status quo, which, let's face it, is a global spyware crisis. And our investigations also often involve external partners. So probably the most well-known example is the Pegasus Project. Those revelations came out in 2021, and that was a collaboration with 17 media organizations in 10 countries, coordinated by Forbidden Stories. So we provided technical support in that case to conduct tests on mobile phones to identify the traces of Pegasus spyware. And more recent collaborative investigations include our work on predator spyware called Predator Files in 2023, and just this year, an investigation in May focusing on Indonesia. I just also want to mention another key aspect to our work in the Security Lab, and that's helping people, activists, researchers, journalists, to protect themselves from attacks. So our technologists build tools, for example, MVT, which is our mobile verification toolkit. And that's a software that allows anyone, albeit with a bit of a technical background, to check a backup of their own smartphone for indicators of spyware infection. So we also, you know, work with the wider digital community to help them identify and respond to digital threats. And finally, we also have a new fellowship training program in its second year now called the Digital Forensics Fellowship. That's for human rights defenders around the world to build their capacity and learning on forensics. And this is really, really central to the ethos of our work at the Security Lab. You know, it's quite clear that the world needs the technical capacity at this advanced level to be decentralized, really global, in order to respond to this crisis of unlawful surveillance that we're facing.
Alina, let me turn to you. We mentioned Pegasus just now, and spyware is a key component of digital surveillance. Spyware vendors often maintain an air of secrecy around their products. However, your team has successfully uncovered a lot of interesting information on the techniques and tactics and operations of spyware vendors. Could you give us a brief overview of how spyware and the industry operate?
Yeah, of course. So I think that the point that you mentioned right now is one of the key elements of people understanding how the spyware industry works. It does benefit from a layer of covert sort of nature, which is what allows them oftentimes to be able to carry on with the development and sale and transfer and deployment of these technologies. But before maybe going into how we see the spyware industry operating, it will be good to share a little bit about what we consider spyware, you know, in terms of our work and what we understand as spyware from Amnesty International. So we have a sort of two categories of spyware. Spyware, in essence, is just software that allows to spy on people. As I was saying earlier, we all as individuals come across and use different forms of software throughout our day. I'm going to refrain from mentioning any specific concrete examples from it, but you can all imagine anything that you can use to draft documents, to navigate the web. I mean, many of those instances could be considered as software, or at least technology products. Within that sort of family, we have spyware. We refer to a very specific type of spyware that we call highly invasive spyware. So the likes of Predator and Pegasus are within this category, which is a type of spyware that can be delivered to a mobile device using either one-click attacks or zero-click attacks. This refers to whether a user needs to interact with a link or anything, you know, email a link or something that can facilitate the infection. That's one click attack, or the zero click attack, which is one of the main elements of this type of spyware and is one of the things that makes them significantly attractive to clients, is that it doesn't need a user to interact with anything for an attack to be successful, and therefore for a device to be infected. Within this form of highly invasive spyware, like I mentioned, the idea is that through an attack, then the user of the spyware, so the individual behind the attack, is able to deliver more often than not a silent infection into the target. So the individual is very limited. It's almost impossible for the individual to know if he has, you know, if the person has been targeted or not, let alone providing evidence for that. And that is where our forensic analysis, it comes in as key. And once the infection is successful, then the person, the user of the spyware, can have access to, unlimited access to your data within the device that has been targeted. So we think it's important to mention that. We try to explain it in plain language as much as possible, because one of the things that we believe is important for everyone to bear in mind when we talk about this kind of spyware is that from the design, like from day zero, once the development of this type of spyware like Predator or Pegasus starts, there is this goal or aspiration to make it as stealth as possible and as untraceable as possible and as capable of being able to insert itself into any device and gather all data possible. So from our perspective, this means that they cannot be checked. There's no system of checks and balances. There's no system of accountability or safeguards that could be put in place for this type of spyware to be used in a way that can be human rights compliant. And that's why we call for a ban of this form of spyware. We believe that in a world where these tools do not exist, and they should not exist, because people should not be put at risk of being put under surveillance without having any resource to counter that. Right? So we believe, again, highly invasive spyware should be absolutely banned. Other forms of spyware that can still facilitate access to data in a sort of stealth, covert way, but that perhaps from the development of it can have other forms of safeguards, and we believe that they should be regulated. There should be a global human rights-based regulatory system for them to be able to exist in this world. And again, this is mainly to protect human rights defenders, journalists, and members of civil society that have been targeted with these tools under the excuse or under the alleged reasons, oftentimes of like national security or public order reasons. Now back to how the spyware industry works. So through our research, we have documented how, for example, the Intel X Alliance operates, how NSO Group, the developer of Pegasus, operates. And the elements that they both have in common is that they operate in a murky system that allows them to trade these tools primarily to state clients that feel and consider that these are good resources to conduct state repression and to hold a closer control over those that dissent or those that express a critical and critics to their policies, right? One of the things that we call for, considering how murky can be, is precisely for stronger transparency guidelines so that people anywhere in the world are able to know and understand and follow who are the people and the entities and the companies selling these products and who are the clients on the other side of it, right? So we just released this report on Indonesia documenting how in a murky environment, that's a surprising and concerning amount of sales happen of spyware technology to this one country in Indonesia, and how that was able to happen, allowed by the covert nature of it, and despite the fact that there are export control systems and other forms of legal requirements that are supposed to be used to curb the trade of these tools in a way that's not controlled. And yet our research demonstrates that it's still happening, even though these systems are in place. So we do need to, as societies and as the international community, but in particular states, need to regulate this as it's an urgent matter at this point.
Thank you. That was a very insightful answer. Rebecca, I want to get a more concrete idea for our audience of spyware in action and practice. Could you share a case study or example of spyware operating in the real world?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I love this question because that's kind of my job, and what really attracted me to this job is to look at the kind of human impact and the real world harms of spyware, in this case, because we try to understand, of course, the technology, but more importantly, the impacts of the technology from my side, from mine and Elena's side. So it may sound really obvious, but I can't overstate this. The people that are targeted really are central to all of the work we do, right? And so I've mentioned our larger investigations, and Elena has as well, like on Indonesia and on the Pegasus Project and PEG and Predator Files. But the best way is to hear a story and to hear how it affected somebody's life. So last year on World Press Freedom Day, we revealed that a very high profile journalist in the Dominican Republic, Nuria Piera, had been targeted with Pegasus spyware. So just one case. But this was the first confirmed case in the country. And the third country, in fact, in the Americas after Mexico and El Salvador, where the use of Pegasus had been confirmed to target journalists and human rights defenders. So around the time of her device being infected, which was 2020 and 2021, because she was hacked more than once, Nuria Piera was working on really sensitive investigations into reports of corruption related to government officials and relatives of the former president of the DR, the Dominican Republic. So I'm paraphrasing a bit, but I'd like to use her own words as much as possible. Since, yeah, she was gracious enough to share her story with us. She described finding out she'd been infected as like being in quicksand. She explained to us, to Elena specifically, how she had to work hard not to become neurotic, suspicious, paranoid, and how this bit's really important. It really affected how free she felt to speak up and do her job. And this is really illustrative of how just one individual being hacked can have ripple effects that touch on all of us, on society. So if we think that this is the first time Pegasus was confirmed in the Dominican Republic, you can ask yourself, you know, what could that do to the freedom of the press in that country, for example? We all know that a free press is critical to a healthy society that respects human rights. So, you know, what did these revelations do to, or how do they affect bloggers or students or other journalists who may want to question or criticize their government or instruments of power in their country? Like, what message is this sending to everyone? She also said that when speaking about being paranoid, that she didn't know sometimes how they wanted to hurt her, like to hurt her directly or through her loved ones. And that was really powerful and struck me. It made me think of another really well-known journalist in Latin America, from Mexico, Carmen Aristegui, who's, excuse my pronunciation, and her son was targeted with Pegasus. And, you know, he was just 16 at the time, so a child. It's terrifying. And sticking with the region, El Salvador is a really good example of how of this kind of chilling effect on journalists and this ripple effect and how destructive spyware can be. So dozens of journalists have been targeted in El Salvador, including 22 just from one publication, El Faro. And this led to last year El Faro announcing it had to move its like operations, its administrative and legal structure to another country, to Costa Rica, in order to continue functioning. So this is really kind of powerful, terrifying stuff. And at Amnesty, we always approach our work with an intersectional lens. So we're already asking ourselves these kind of questions when we're hearing these testimonies, like how are different people affected depending on who they are or their positionality? In what ways, for example, might a woman be more severely or differently affected by a Pegasus attack than a man? Or how might it affect you if you're from a marginalized group or already facing discrimination or oppression by people in power? So in the case of women journalists here, surveillance like this can be harmful on a whole new level.
Wow, thank you. I think that speaking about cybersecurity or technology, we can often abstract too far from the impact, you know, on people in the real world. So thank you for that. Now, Alina, I know you've done research on the gendered impacts of this type of surveillance. Could you share what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think building on what Rebecca was saying, a big part of our work research-wise has been focused so far on uncovering and documenting how the industry operates and how, as I was saying earlier, this ecosystem of surveillance suppliers and brokers and resellers enjoy or take profit of like operating in this covert space in order to proceed to sell and transfer surveillance technology. And I think our latest report on that from Indonesia can sheds really good light into how that operates. The other side of that coin is, as Rebecca was mentioning, the human rights impacts of that. We have documented in general how the use of spyware has not only a direct impact and can cause human rights violations of the right to privacy and other connected rights, but also how it can generate a chilling effect, by which we mean it's a context in which individuals refrain from exercising their rights because of fear of reprisals, right? We identified, though, that within this sort of two layers of our research work, we hadn't had an opportunity to document specifically how gender could operate and have an influence in intersection or related to the use of surveillance. And being an individual that had been targeted by unlawful digital surveillance. So that led us to map out how, through our research work, we could contribute to supplementing that gap, because there are other incredible organizations that have been building links between, gender and feminist analysis and the impacts of technology in general, but within the specific issue of surveillance and targeted surveillance at that, there was still an opportunity for us to contribute further. So it was with this in mind that we embarked on documenting how women and LGBTI human rights defenders in Thailand that had been impacted by targeted surveillance experienced this from a gender perspective. So perhaps it's important for all the listeners to have a little bit of context of what the situation in Thailand is, which is one of the main reasons why, in partnership with other teams within Amnesty International and partners on the ground in the country, we decided to embark on this project. But Thailand, especially since 2020, has seen a rise of youth-led pro-democracy movements and protests that are calling for changes in the country. And while these movements have been rising with incredible bravery and power of influence, the Thai authorities have, instead of embracing the opportunity for change and the possibility of building a new social contract with these demands, they have decided to respond, targeting these individuals and by performing a crackdown on freedom of expression and other rights. So within this environment, we have documented that women and LGBTI human rights defenders in Thailand have primarily endured two forms of what we're also calling technology-facilitated gender-based violence. And here, perhaps a bit of a disclaimer, this is not a term that we came up with by any means. This is a term, technology-facilitated gender-based violence, that has been in the works for several years, primarily from feminist thinkers and even UN women. But we have decided to embrace this as an umbrella term because we understand that it allows for all of us in this space to be able to name how the continuum between online and offline spaces connected to gender-based violence can exacerbate, can mirror, can amplify the harms that women and LGBTI people experience, both in digital spaces and in offline spaces. So having this in mind, we have documented how in Thailand, targeted digital surveillance and online harassment are two of the primary forms of this tech-facilitated gender-based violence that women and LGBTI people, especially those that are involving human rights work face. And for the purposes of our conversation today, it's important, right, to bring the focus on how this digital surveillance has operated in the country. So we decided to build on the work that Citizen Lab, was a partner organization that we have worked in the past with, had released along with ILO, that is a local Thai organization focused on these issues as well. They had found how 35 individuals in Thailand had been targeted with Pegasus spyware from 2020 onwards, and 15 of them were cisgender women. And so building on that, whose results we were able to independently analyze at the time and able to verify that indeed it was Pegasus, the spyware behind these attacks, we decided to embark on, well, what did it mean for this woman and LGBTI people to have been an individual targeted with surveillance, or to be in an environment in which you know that your peer, that your colleague, that your sister that is with you on the ground trying to bring about change in the country was targeted with surveillance? What does that mean for the group and for the movement that you are a part of? And one of the main primary things that we identified in this particular instance of gendered impacts of surveillance is precisely how even though perhaps the tactics behind the targeting and, you know, deciding who is going to be placed under surveillance might not have been gendered, we were not able to find evidence to back that up necessarily. We did find evidence demonstrating how the experience of being on the other side of the attack is definitely different and is influenced by gender. The way that these women and LGBTI people described to us how they felt definitely gave indicators of a gendered fear of how being concerned over how your data, or their data in this case, will be used, how their reputations could be brought to the ground using information that they could have targeted, not necessarily because they were engaged in anything that could be censored or considered as quote unquote wrong, but just because by being a woman or being an LGBTI individual in the public space in a context like the Thai one could just bring about any sort of criticisms already just by being the one of these individuals in the space. Imagine how having private information about you, who you relate to, where do you go to, where are you going to be in a particular day could have as well on you. So that was one of the main elements that we identified within this gendered impacts, the fear and anxiety among the human rights defenders of how their private data could be used.
Thank you for that, Alina. Let me stay with you for now. We have talked a lot about research, but I'd like to ask you more about your advocacy work. Can you explain how you advocate for a safer space for at-risk groups such as journalists and human rights defenders, and talk about the global initiatives that you're engaged in?
Yeah, sure. So I think a big part of the work that we do as the Security Lab, being a part of Amnesty International, is also rooted in being able to promote change, right? And advocacy is one of our tactics. So like I mentioned earlier, a big part of our research has led to us adopting the policy calls of urging states to adopt a ban on highly invasive spyware and implement a global human rights compliance regulatory system that includes not just stronger export controls. Like I mentioned, we have some of those in certain regions of the world and in particular countries, but clearly they're not enough, but also accountability mechanisms and independent oversight mechanisms. Within these two elements that I just mentioned, there's also what we call a global moratorium on the sale and use and transfer and export of these technologies until both a ban and a stronger regulatory framework are put in place. So we use these calls to engage with states all over the world and try to urge them to use their regulatory powers to bring this about. Recently, we were able to be a part of, for example, the Pall Mall process in the UK and the Paris Peace Forum in France, which are two key spaces for us to be able to engage with states and other members of the ecosystem, including partners from civil society and even spyware companies to try and bring about these goals. Last year, we were a part of the PEGA committee process that started in the European Union Parliament, which was specifically looking into the use of Pegasus by member states of the European Union. And again, from our perspective, we were engaging in national and international advocacy to get to the recognition that using spyware has to be regulated, specific forms of spyware should be banned, and that specifically in the context of the European Union, but I would say it applies to all countries around the world, is that the use of terms like national security or public order, although these are recognized exemptions or conditions to impose restrictions on internationally recognized human rights, like the right to privacy and rights to freedom of expression, they are very narrowly defined, both in international law and in many national legislations. So they should not be used as a blanket term for states to be able to use spyware or other technology tools and surveil on people. In the US, we have also seen developments recently, in particular the executive order was issued by the Biden administration calling for a prohibition of the use of what they denominate as commercial spyware by federal agencies. We think that overall, all of these instances are steps that we welcome. They indicate some levels of movement around the regulation of spyware. However, we would like to see even more because as our research has documented, on and on, the impacts of surveillance are way too high on the individuals that bravely decide to just speak out and speak up their minds and organize themselves in order to protect human rights or document and inform about what's happening. So human rights defenders and journalists have a very high price to pay and when they're put against the impacts of spyware. And we believe that states have a duty, not only a legal duty under international human rights law, to be able to protect them from these harms and not engage in it as well, but also I will say a duty in light of the rule of law to make sure that these tools are properly regulated and used in a way that anyone, no matter where they are in the world, can make sure that, you know, that its use is performed in a way that's accountable, that's transparent, and that is safe for all.
Rebecca, turning to you, I have a final question. We've recently read a lot about Apple threat notifications that some researchers and journalists have been getting on their phones. People have been hacked with this highly intrusive surveillance software. Can you explain to our audience what these are and maybe what one should do should they find themselves in the unfortunate position of receiving one? I know that Amnesty also can provide some assistance. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So Apple has been sending threat notifications like these since 2021. And in April this year, they sent threat notifications to iPhone users in 92 countries. And the round before that was sent in October 2023. So these happen quite regularly. In fact, on the Apple support page itself, it says that they send these notifications multiple times a year, and that they have notified users today in over 150 countries. You know, if I think of Amnesty's annual report that's just come out documenting the state of human rights, that covers 150 countries, 155, excuse me, covers 155 countries. And in 150 countries, Apple have sent out these threat notifications. They also say that the sort of extreme cost and sophistication of these spyware attacks makes them some of the most advanced digital threats in existence today. Mentioning that this issue is ongoing and global, as we know. So basically what happens is the user will get a message saying that their device and their Apple device is being targeted by a mercenary spyware attack. And that they're being targeted because of who they are and what they do. So as we all know, this often means people speaking truth to power, journalists, activists, bloggers, human rights defenders, members of civil society, as well as politicians and diplomats, etc. So it's important to point out that if you receive one of these threat alerts, it doesn't necessarily mean that an attacker has succeeded in infecting your device or implanting spyware on your phone. It just means that there's been an attempt to do so. So only a forensic analysis can actually confirm if a device has been compromised. Now, our security lab, along with other groups and partners like Citizen Lab and Access Now, have carried out forensic tests on devices with many members of civil society who have received these Apple threat notifications and indeed have confirmed cases of the use of highly invasive spyware like Pegasus in Serbia, Armenia, Jordan, India. So if you are listening to this and you've received an alert, then yeah, support is available, as you mentioned in your question. If you are a member of civil society, then you can contact us directly at Security Lab and you can request forensic support. We can check your devices. So you can find that link on our website, securitylab.amnesty.org. And then also on that website, you can find links to details of our partners and other organizations that also provide this kind of help and support. And a good place to start is the Access Now helpline, for example, and also other general digital security resources. So don't panic. Help is available, basically.
Great. Thank you. It's good to hear there are at least some options for those whose devices might have been attacked. Well, that's all for today. So thank you both so much for appearing on the Berlin Security Beat.
Thanks to you.
It was a pleasure. And it was really nice doing this together with my colleague, Elena, as well. So thanks for having both of us on together.
And thanks to all of you in our audience for tuning in. Please subscribe to the Center for International Security at the Hertie School across all our channels. And remember that this season is still not over. We will be bringing you quite a few really interesting episodes over the summer, with the next one on AI security. So stay tuned, and until then, this is David Bukowski coming to you from Berlin.